Today is Friday, April 14th, 2017. It is 9 a.m., and this is panel number 5116, entitled The Human Desire for Narrative. I'm Melinda Miller. I work in the New College of Media Communication and Information, and I have 2 degrees from here, one in English and one in journalism. So I am both a poet and a journalist. I'm very excited to join them on this panel this morning. I'm going to introduce the panel. Mary Reynolds Thompson is an international teacher, facilitator of poetry and journal therapy, and eco-coach in the emerging field of spiritual ecology. She fell in love with the wild earth as a young child when she rode a pig called Ramona through the hills of southern Italy. Her book, Reclaiming the Wild Soul, takes us on a journey into Earth's 5 great landscapes, deserts, forests, oceans, and rivers, mountains, and grasslands. So I'm very interested in hearing what else you have to say. Eric Lindstrom has a climate focus area lead in the Science Mission Directorate at NASA in Washington, D.C. His scientific interests include the circulation of the ocean and air-sea exchange processes and include experience in both seagoing oceanography and remote sensing. He shared that he, when he can get out of D.C., he goes to sea still, and there he's a photographer and blogger, and he makes himself write 1,500 words a day and tells a story, so we'll be hearing more about that. Amy Fox is a screenwriter, playwright, and professor at the NYU Tisch School of the Arts. She writes screenplays, plays, and nonfiction. Most recently, she wrote the screenplay to Equity, the female-driven Wall Street film which premiered at Sundance in last spring. Equity has been called a suspenseful feminist thriller by the New York Times and aims to tell a great story while furthering the conversation about gender in the workplace. And last but not least, we have Willow Wilson. She's a novelist and comic book writer. She is best known for the New York Times bestselling comic book series, Miss Marvel, which won the Hugo Award in 2015. She's also written The Butterfly Mosque, the story of an American girl from a secular East Coast background who converts to Islam.
Good morning, everyone. I know the acoustics in here aren't brilliant, so can you hear me? Great. I'll try and keep my voice quite high. My dad died of emphysema, which is not a great way to go, but it is a way that allows you to consider your passing, because it is a sort of slow death. And in the last few years of his life, he read biography after biography. And I think in his own way, what he was really trying to do was to see what a life looks like, what the beginning and middle and end of a life is really all about. And the truth is that we are simply wired as humans to lock in to narrative. You know, we even live, thank you for doing that, by the way. That's great. I can now. Okay. So we live in a universe that we know has a beginning, and we are somewhere in the exciting middle of that story, and we know that the sun will not go on forever, and at least our earthly life and the ability for life to exist on Earth will end. So right keyed and coded into the very cells of our being is this idea of narrative story. More than that, it's a kind of biological imperative. So our brains are saying to us, and I'm not a scientist, so correct me if I get this wrong, but our brains are saying to us, there is so much information coming at us, like boom, 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 boom. We need narrative structure so that we can essentially just sort of sort out the bits that fit into the storyline, right? because otherwise we'd be so bombarded and overwhelmed by all the information we wouldn't know what to do. And our brain's essentially saying we don't have the capacity for that. So it really helps us to have a sort of narrative structure into which we can fit and fill the story. And we make up story when there isn't even story. I discovered in the process of thinking about this panel that Fritz Haider and Mary Ann Simmel in the 1940s did this sort of test, and they put on a screen these geometric figures, and they moved them around this screen and then asked people what they were seeing. They were seeing princesses and wars and battles, and only one person in this sort of focus group said, well, I'm seeing triangles moving from right to left, right? So even when there's no story, we're going to fill it in with story, which is really a challenge for us, right? Because I think what I'm really saying is that story isn't an absolute. A narrative isn't a absolute series and sets of truth structured out. It's really a way that we make sense and meaning of the world. A friend and colleague of mine calls it a living, breathing story. And right now we can see a world in which people are really hanging on very hard and rigidly to their particular narratives, right? This is the truth, right? No. This is the way that we make sense of things. And my way isn't your way. And it's born of imagination, you know, really, it's born of imagination. And deeply, deeply, this desire to have lives of meaning, right? To have a mythic life, to begin to explore the threads and significances and ways that amidst all the noise, there's a siren of song that is our song in the world. And we all long for that. It's this discovery of the daemon, the gift that we come here to bring, right? We're really looking for that. And so narrative helps us begin to search for that. You know, I work with a lot of people who write memoir. And many of them aren't writing for publication. They're writing because they want to uncover the thread of their own lives. So I think this is an incredibly important thing, that whether we consider ourselves to be writers or not, we give ourselves full permission to really explore our own narratives and our own stories. One of the ways that I'm really interested in looking at story, because I am eco-spirit, is looking at our stories as they connect to the natural world. And about four years ago, I started collecting what I call wild soul stories. And this was inspired by a man called Thomas Berry, who's a cultural theologian, who is really deeply embedded in what he calls the universe story, which is the great cosmological story, but also the earth story. And he tells in his book this wonderful tale of being about 11 years old when his parents moved him out of the city into the suburbs. And the first thing he did was he went out exploring, and he crossed the creek and he entered this meadow. And in this meadow were lilies and bees and the rustling wind, and he could hear the creek and the dancing of butterflies. And he saw this amazingly harmonious space where everything, he wouldn't have put it in those words back at the age of 11, was interdependent, interconnected. And later in his life, he said he put everything to the test. Is this good for the meadow? Or is it not good for the meadow? And so what I've been doing is collecting stories from activists and poets and writers and comedians and Republicans and Democrats about a moment of connection to the natural world that has influenced them, had that ability to actually shape going forward a narrative of their own life, that it had such a profound impact. And one of the things that I believe in hugely about telling our stories about connecting to nature is these are places of common ground. There's very rare that you'll meet a person who doesn't have a story about a tree or a wonderful camping trip or a river, less so with kids now, and I'm really aware of that. But it's a great meeting place. And then whatever story we tell, we just reflect and we go, what does that mean to us? Who am I now because I had that experience? How does it help me discover the thread? Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Eric?
Thanks very much. I feel a bit of fish out of water here, an oceanographer and a narrative panel. But I have a little bit of a love of writing and storytelling. And surprisingly, that came about in college at MIT, which there are no English classes there, as far as I can tell. So I don't have no training there. But I took the discipline of taking an art history course every semester. And the discipline there was to write about a painting every week. And it exposed me to art and how to draw out a narrative about this object, this painting, whatever, and doing it over and over again. And so that the desire to do that has never left. Scientists, however, for the most part, are not good storytellers. I don't know what it is about being a scientist, but as a program manager in Washington, I get exposed to a lot of their writing and a lot of their proposals, and despite all the writing they do, they can't seem to tell a story. And what I've learned, which sort of brought me here, was this idea that, as Mary has said, this humans are built in to desire the story. And scientists desire the story, but they can't seem to get a story out. And so in the peer review process, which they do with papers and we do with grading proposals, what's going to get funded or not, the people that succeed are the people that can break through with a narrative in their proposal, particularly, is if they can have a good story and then build all the technical bits around it. Peer reviewers fall in love with the story first, and then they worry about the technical, scientific merit and other things. But absent a good story, which is most of the proposals, we decide, well, there's 80% we don't have to fund. That's normally the success rate's about 20%. And I can tell you that it's in those 20% that you find the storytellers. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the technical writing is pretty linear in science. I think, I don't know if that's the right word to describe it, but it's certainly boring. If I'm having trouble sleeping, I take the Journal of Physical Oceanography and read it. And, yeah, it's just... I don't know how we manage to churn out all this stuff and have it be so dry. Mm-hmm. I pretty much got drummed out of being a bench scientist or working to, because writing the technical papers was not very much fun. The peer reviewers would come back and hit me over the head for my flowery writing. Yeah. So, yeah, you just can't win. So I feel like I'm here. I want to learn something out of this panel is by what process could I motivate our scientists to tell a better story? Is there some subliminal message that I can get out there, or is there some training, practice that could improve this skill. I feel like I went through it by accident in writing about art for so long, and I try and practice. When I go to sea, I love going to sea. I got beamed up to work at NASA. That's but the ocean is my love, and so I'm taking NASA to sea now. Whether they like it or not, they're going to sea. And so instead of, I have plenty of scientists. I can fund scientists to go do the work at sea. So I tag along and write about their science for them. Try and articulate this experiment, that person, this grad student, and blog about that. So there's this online story being told about our expeditions. And NASA loves it. So we have a whole section of our Earth Observer website that's just devoted to people blogging about field programs. And we have a good following there. So I'm going to stop talking and start listening and figure out how I can make scientists better storytellers.
So I was going to say, NASA overall does an incredible job of their storytelling. Thank you, Eric.
Hi, good morning. Well, I teach storytelling, so I can offer a few suggestions. It's been a really fun week for me. My life is pretty much surrounded by storytellers at all times. I'm one myself. I teach them. Not all, but many of my friends are storytellers in various genres of theater and film and fiction. And it's been really fun for me to be up on these panels with people that don't necessarily traffic in storytelling as much as I do, and particularly on some of the panels about art, there have been some more abstract artists, which has been fun for me because I need to be reminded sometimes that, you know, there are art forms, as you said, Mary, that where we kind of have to find our own story, whereas the art form I do, we do find our own story, but the story that the writer puts together is a little more directed than, say, when we look at a painting or a dance. So it's been a fun week for me. I do believe that humans have a deep primal need for story. I also think having, in the process of raising two kids, I think it starts very early, but I also am very fascinated by how quickly we impart to children that is the way to see the world, how quickly they learn from us that the beginning, middle, end, the once upon a time. I have two kids. My husband works in science communication, so in my family, there's both of us use language to communicate, and I have two kids that are, you know, they're born storytellers, but I don't know if they're born storytellers. I think they are, but I can also see how quickly they learned from us that this is how you organize your thinking about the world. So I have a lot of thoughts. I mean, I think that one of the things that has come up this week is that stories are very powerful, maybe because of this primal need that we have to organize our experience into narrative. I think primarily that's a positive thing. I think that's a good thing. I think, you know, I was on a panel the other day with Michelle, who works with Eric at NASA, and she was talking about how, similar to what you're saying, that if we want the public to really care about science, that we can't just give them facts, that we have to engage them emotionally. And I think that's what stories do when we share them. They engage people in a kind of ritualistic, emotional connection to something. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Primarily, at least in dramatic writing, which is what I do, it's the idea of giving people something to root for. Now, perhaps what they're rooting for happens, or perhaps it doesn't, right? Your story can have a tragic ending. In fact, my film screened here last night, my film Equity, has sort of a dark ending, and it's been really interesting to watch the power of that and how upset it makes a lot of people, because it's not the ending that they're rooting for. And that's interesting. It's interesting to play with that dynamic. But I think as a dramatic storyteller, what I try to be aware of when I'm constructing something is, what is my audience rooting for? What do they want to happen? And it's not that I'm necessarily going to give them that, but that's a powerful force. A lot of times when I'm teaching playwriting or screenwriting, I talk about sports games, and I'm not a sports fan myself, but I'm interested in sports fans. I'm interested in how passionate they are, because nobody gets that passionate when they come to see my plays. You don't see people you know, hitting the wall and screaming at each other because they, my characters didn't get what they want. And I want to know why. I want to know what is the power of a sports game. And I think part of it is that we have something to root for, and it happens in the present moment. It's very different to watch a game unfold not knowing what is going to happen than it is to turn on, you know, the ESPN later and hear someone say, what happened with the Cubs today was like, and I think when I teach dramatic storytelling, that's what I try to get across is the idea that it has to unfold in the present moment. You can't be summarizing for people something that's already happened if you want them to be engaged, at least in theater or film. This idea that something is unfolding before our eyes and we don't exactly know how it's going to turn out, but we are engaged in what we want to happen to the character. So that's kind of what I play with. What else did I want to say? I can come back to this in more detail later, but one of the things for me in teaching storytelling and thinking about storytelling is that so much of it for me, so much of narrative is the order in which we place events and sort of how we choose our beginning, our middle, and our end, right? So when you talk about these stories of people that were influenced by some memory, some moment in nature, and when you ask them to tell those stories, that's sort of going to be the natural starting point for them, right? Of, or it's going to be, or they're going to start the story before that, before they had that relationship with the natural world, and then that incident is going to trigger a change. To me, so much of storytelling is about understanding that events trigger changes in us. And the way we tell our stories is, from a craft perspective, as someone who trains in the craft, it's about choosing where do we start that narrative? What incidents do we start with? And do we show them in chronological order? Do we mix up that order? How does that have a different impact? And where do we end them? So I've been using the current political situation, not to derail our panel, but I've been using it as an example in my teaching because one of the lenses that I view it through is that we're witnessing some extraordinary events. And I have seen a bunch of posts. I can't say where this originated because I've seen it a bunch, but I saw it again this morning where someone wrote on Facebook, I never wanted to live in interesting times. We're living in interesting times, whether we wanted to or not. For me, it's been really interesting because I was very much an activist when I was younger. I come from a family of activists, and I had kind of let that go a lot in my personal story as I had gotten more invested in my career and raising a family. I sort of practice my values on a daily basis, but I hadn't been politically active for some time. I mean, I voted, but... And what's interesting is that I think for a lot of people right now, certainly not for everyone, but for a lot of people, I think that that was true and that that may have changed on November 8th. What's interesting for me is that it changed on November 7th in a really dramatic way because the entire campaign I sort of intended to canvass and I intended to make phone calls and I intended to do all these things and life kind of got away from me. And then a friend called me sort of literally the week before the election and said, I'm going to canvass for Hillary in Pennsylvania on November 7th. Would you come? And I actually had a whole bunch of obligations that day, but I just thought, I have to do this, you know. And I don't really pat myself on the back for it because I think I should have showed up long before November 7th, but I did cancel everything and I did go that day. And it was a very, very profound day. Of talking to, and we weren't changing anyone's mind that late in the game, but talking to people that clearly were going to vote for Hillary or were not, and really seeing some very different neighborhoods in the Lehigh Valley where we were. And it completely changed the way the election hit me. I can only imagine how the election hit people whose narrative of involvement in the campaign had started sooner. But for me, I had this very deep emotional experience the day before. And so I, you know, that changed my narrative. It changed the way that that the election felt, the way that I've conducted myself in the aftermath. And I'm just interested in that. I'm interested in the order of events. Where do we start our stories? What are the events that trigger change? And, you know, wherever they will take us.
Thank you.
So people don't really listen to stories with their brains. They listen to stories with their guts. And I think that's something important to remember when you're telling a story, because no matter what kind of story you're telling, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, whether it's fantasy or a comic book or a play, what you are really doing is asking someone to invest a part of themselves in a story that might not be about them directly, but which, in which they are looking for some kind of relevance to their own lives. And this is something that I started thinking about a great deal the first time I got the call from Marvel Comics to start creating Ms. Marvel. It kind of came out of the blue. I'd been focusing on books without pictures for several years. I had two books and two babies in the space of 20 months and had been pregnant on two book tours. I don't recommend this, by the way. So I hadn't been doing a whole lot of work in comics aside from one or two small things. And then one day I got a phone call out of the blue from Sana Aminat and Stephen Wacker, who were two editors at Marvel Comics, and they said, "We have this thing we think you'll be interested in. We want to create a new young American Muslim superheroine from scratch and put her on her own ongoing series." And I was shocked. I was utterly shocked. I'd sort of spent most of my time in comics trying to kind of fly below the radar and not do anything too political and draw attention to myself, because it was not a good time to sort of be a confluence of seemingly contradictory things in the entertainment industry. So I almost said no, because I knew the volume of hate mail that we were going to get, and actually suggested to them that they hire an intern specifically for this purpose. Otherwise, our inboxes were all going to get flooded. But nevertheless, you know, when a huge, giant entertainment corporation like Marvel, which is an arm of Disney now, asks you to do something like that, to create a narrative where there was none, to bring two communities together that would not seem to have common ground and are often portrayed as being at cross purposes, was too good to pass up. But shockingly to me, it was very, very difficult to create this character. It was difficult to even think about, because for so many decades, when you said the word Muslim in conjunction with the word comic book or cartoon, you were talking about a bad guy. And I had to rethink a lot of things, both about that narrative and about what it means to be a superhero, because superheroes are good guys whose power is rooted in violence. You know, what does Superman do? He's got super strength. He can throw cars. He's got beams of lasers that he can shoot out of his eyes. Wolverine has giant claws that he uses to impale people. Cyclops can't even take off his special little ruby filtration glasses without beaming somebody in the face. So there's a very destructive element to the superhero narrative that I knew was not going to mesh well with this character. And so we went back and forth, and Sana Aminat, who became the series editor, and I knew that sort of all eyes were on us, and that this was the first time in the history of American comics that a Muslim editor and a Muslim writer were working together. I mean, you kind of, when you're in a highly disliked sort of visible outsider group, you kind of try to avoid each other, not to draw attention to one another, because then it's like you're forming a group and people get especially nervous. So it was very difficult to kind of suss this all out with all of the emotions that we both had about all of these topics. And I originally thought, well, let's just be sort of ironic about it. You know, let's do something that's very tongue-in-cheek. We're acknowledging all the inherent contradictions here. You know, we'll sort of, this will be kind of a very kick-splody, meta take on the superhero genre. And she kept saying, no, you got to drill down, get to the essential superhero narrative. You know, if you were to make a Muslim Peter Parker story, Peter Parker is Spider-Man, for those of you who do not follow comics, what would that look like? What's the Uncle Ben moment? What's the with great power comes great responsibility? Drill down and get to that. And I said, okay, I'm going to drill down. I'm going to get to that. And I sat and I sat and I sat with it for months, and I just couldn't get there. And then came the Boston Marathon bombing. And I called Sana and I was like, we have to rethink everything. This is now, you know, it's everything has changed. And I was sort of holding on to this hope that, well, maybe it will not be the same old story. Maybe it will not be the same old narrative. Maybe it will be something else. There had been sort of a spate of much less destructive but still significant minor incidents involving right-wing violence in sort of the months previous to that. And I was like, maybe it's one of those guys. And she said to me, and she's very laid back, but she had this sharp tone in her voice. She was like, Willow, do not be naive. And as the story started to come out, and I recognized the two very young brothers who were involved with this, I was like, oh my gosh, it's always the same story with these kids. You know, they're the pot-smoking, cool guys, and then all of a sudden something happens, and they flip. And that something is usually they are orphaned between two narratives. They are either born here, two parents from somewhere else, or come here from somewhere else, thinking that if they just fit in and they're the cool guys, that they'll be accepted. And they don't realize that as long as they've got names that sound funny to the majority of Americans and accents that sound funny to the majority of Americans, they will never become one of us. And yet they are no longer one of them. And there is no narrative that encompasses both of those things. And I started to think about the entire series, the entire theory of Ms. Marvel in a very different way. I thought, if I could put something in their hands, if I could put a narrative, a story in their hands that was different than the one that they were told, in which they were not orphans, in which they could be part of both of those worlds without losing too much from each, what would that look like? And in 24 hours, I had a story. And I don't think any of us expected it to be successful. I mean, Son and I used to joke to each other that, you know, well, we'll hope that it does well, but it's not like they're going to put her on the Avengers, ha ha ha. Because the character, as she finally coalesced, was sort of the trinity of things that don't sell by the old industry of math. New characters don't sell, female characters don't sell, minority characters don't sell. So we had very frank conversations about having a three-issue exit strategy for when the series inevitably flopped. But, you know, it was also freeing because I could tell, and Sana as well, and Adrian Alfano, the series artist, exactly the kind of story we wanted to tell. And so we told the story of this 16-year-old Pakistani-American girl from Jersey City who wakes up with superpowers and has to figure out what that means for her and how to reconcile not only two different cultural identities, but also a tremendous secret that she knows that nobody else around her could really understand. And we kind of sent it out, and I was like, okay, I've got my three-issue exit strategy here in my pocket. And issue one got 8 printings. And the digital edition became, at that time, the highest-selling digital comic book that Marvel had ever released. And the first 3 anthologies ended up on the New York Times bestseller list for graphic novels. And that's when I realized that there are a lot of orphans out there. And the people who come up to me and say that the book had touched them are not always from communities that one might expect. And it really struck me that, especially in a time like this, if we don't have narratives that we feel we are invested in, stories in which we are the heroes, we will turn to nihilism. And we've seen that on sort of both sides, well, it's not even sides, all sort of points of the political spectrum. And so that's something that I've tried to carry forward in my own work since then, to create those lifeboats for people who feel that they've been thrown out of the big ship of civilization and tell them that they're not going to drown.
We're opening it up to the panel to comment on each other's, but I just want to encourage you that the panel's very interested in receiving questions. So if you want to start sending questions to the app, we'll be taking those in a few minutes.
There's some feedback going on.
Yeah.
So when you started Willow, you made a point that really struck me about, I might paraphrase, about good stories aiming at the gut and not the brain. And it seems like, well, there's scientists are aiming their stories at the brain and not the gut. And any scientist who tries to get at the gut through their technical writing gets taken out by the reviewers. And so how do we, but there's this, as Mary said, there's a, we want to get the full.
Ready for liftoff now.
Ooh.
Whoa. Okay, so.
Okay.
Sure enough. So the sense and meaning of the work is what you want to get through in the narrative, and somehow we want to have that emotional connection. Science needs to have. We need to get to people with these facts and challenges and in an emotional way, not just transmit the facts. And so I feel like there's a we've got to figure out a way to allow that to be okay for scientists to do that.
Well, I had wanted to respond earlier when you sort of posed the question about how can you be trained, and I do believe that it's like a muscle, like anything else, that storytelling is something you can strengthen your storytelling muscle. I think you did that by writing about those paintings, and you do that by writing every day. And I think, again, that storytelling, it's almost like you're talking about these scientists that have been, I believe that they were born with the same primal storytelling ability as everyone else. It's just been trained out of them by this kind of writing you're talking about. So how to get back to that kind of childlike way of organizing the world. And I think there's a lot of ways, but I do think daily writing, there's a bunch of writing teachers out there that sort of advocate writing practice of one form or another. My favorite is Natalie Goldberg, who's a Buddhist writing teacher, and she talks about writing as a practice, as something you do like a yoga practice or meditation, that you're not doing necessarily, some people do it for a result if it's your work, but that you can also do it as a daily meditation, and she sort of offers prompts in her books for that. So I do think it can be kind of trained like a muscle. And something that I just wanted, that a teacher had told me, she didn't tell us. There was a very small writing class I was in when I was 19, and the woman who led it, a teacher named Wendy Hammond, one day we came into class, there were five of us, and she said, okay, here's what we're doing today. Everyone write down five events which changed your life. So we were 19, so we had some events. We didn't have as many events as I might have now. And then she said, pick one. And the interesting thing about that, just the piece of that, was that the first three I wrote down were the ones that other people had sort of, they were sort of the most obvious things. You know, there are things that, so like my grandmother had died. Now that's a big deal. I could have written about that, but that was sort of an obvious one. It was like that changed my life, and no one would blink if I said that, you know, so that was sort of obvious. But because she asked for five, I had written two things down that were less obvious, that I hadn't talked about as much, that people in my life wouldn't necessarily have said, oh, she's going to write about that. And I ended up choosing one of those, which was very powerful, because I actually discovered that there was something, it had to do with some health issues I was having, that I was sort of putting on a brave face and pretending they weren't bothering me. And when I sat to write about them, I discovered that this was a huge part of my narrative, but I wasn't really seeing it as such. Anyway, I chose one of those, and basically what she said is, I'm going to have each of you go away for 3 hours and write down the story of this thing that changed your life. And I don't want you to think about it as writers. I don't want you to make it sound good. I don't want you to worry about good writing or any of craft, nothing. She's like, your job is simply to start at the beginning and just go through the events. This happened, this happened, this happened, and get to the end. And then bring it back, and we're all going to read them out loud. So it remains one of the most powerful days of my life for me and these four other people to come back, and we had actually become friends. It was a summer writing program. We'd been hanging out for weeks, and we thought we knew each other, and then we were witness to each other's incredibly powerful stories, which again didn't have the goal of trying to be good or get laughs or, you know, it was simply the power of saying this happened, this happened, this happened. And interestingly, I went back to school, to college that fall, and I had a friend who is not a writer and was not a writer, and her father had been diagnosed with cancer that summer, and she was in a very dark place, and she just kept saying to me, I can't make sense of it. And I said, you know, why don't you try this? Like, why don't you just go somewhere and sit down and just write what happened? You know, the first phone call from your dad, just write it, you know. And she is now a psychiatrist, and she still speaks about that as a very empowering moment for her. And again, she's not a writer. We didn't publish it. You know, I don't think I even read it. I think she just went and did it. And I think similar to what you said in the memoirs, that there's something about the power of just this happened to me that I think can't be overstated.
If I can, I have a practical issue that may be helpful to you on sort of like a nuts and bolts way. I think people listen to stories with their guts, but the good news is you get to their guts in a structural way. All you really need is a beginning, middle, and end, and a protagonist. And the protagonist doesn't have to be human. It could be, I don't know, El Nino, or, you know, some sort of undiscovered molecule, or something. It's interesting because you don't, I think there's an assumption that in order to speak to someone on that emotional level, you need to get emotional, when in fact all you need to do is give them a structure into which they can read their own emotions. So I don't know that you, I mean, I see a lot of people who sort of approach issues similar to this and say, well, if I really want to connect to people, I need to use a lot of adjectives and adverbs. When in fact, for a lot of people, that will occlude their experience of that emotional process rather than illuminate anything. So it's the structure, I think, that beginning, middle, and end. There's a central question, what's going to happen, and there's a protagonist, whether it's a person or a pelican.
Everybody said a beautiful response.
You know, I have a question about how do you think environment changes narrative? You know, either the natural environment or kind of like a urban environment.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I sort of lost faith in the modern novel for a while because it seemed to be so disembodied. It seemed to be so unrooted, actually, from environment, from whether it be a cityscape, a natural scape, and so much in the head. I mean, I think of Hamlet, you know, the sort of first real modern protagonist, you know, sitting in his head to be or not to be, that is the question. And how we really got into this sort of just this almost human hubris as though we existed out of context with the world. And so I think, you know, with this whole science writing, it's such an amazing opportunity. And in fact, I was reading on the plane coming here the best nature writing of, I don't know, 2015 or something. And really, I think when you have the protagonist set within the context of an actual place that shapes, restricts, limits, expands, and to which that they then becomes another character almost. I mean, I love books and poetry where one of the great characters is actually the place in which the action happens. And I think it's tremendously important to look for those kinds of narratives, because otherwise we're in a sense promoting this idea that we can exist fully sort of out there, sort of in a bubble, which is completely not the way we actually live, right? You know, we imprint the world, but the world also imprints us. And so I love things like Huck Finn, Down the River. I love your concept of the orphan, because I think so many great books are about characters trying to find their place in the world. You know, where is it, that sense of belonging? But yeah, I think environment is really a rich, rich place to look.
So I feel like going to sea, I almost always feel the urge to be writing more. in the natural environment as opposed to sitting in an office. So I get outside, sitting out on the deck with the notepad, and just let the words flow. The best writing comes from not self-editing. You just write. You just got to get it all out there, and that's what Amy was saying, those days when you just let it all out onto the page, and it's a cathartic kind of experience. And then you can go find the stuff to formally, you know, mix it up or, you know, to get it out for other people to read maybe. But, yeah, the process of writing and telling the story from yourself and not just letting it all go is much easier in a natural environment, I think.
For me, I think, as someone who grew up in Colorado and now has lived in New York for 20 years, I don't have a clear answer about this, but one thing I have been thinking about, and particularly on this trip for whatever reason, is that I think that when you're in a natural environment, an environment of wildlife, you have to sit with yourself in a way. I think that's why books like Wild appeal to us, because it's a very internal journey that can be sparked by the natural environment. And I don't think I'm very good at sitting with myself. At least I wasn't long ago. And I think I went to a city for that reason, because I'm very curious about people. And I think that I wanted to be surrounded by other people's stories, because I didn't really want to sit with mine. And there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, but I think that for me, like, I actually feel much more inspired when there's people of every race and age and gender crashing into me on the street. But I have great respect for those whose inspiration actually comes from, a sort of more symbiotic relationship with the natural world.
I think it's a misnomer that people like to feel big. I think we actually like to feel small, or at least we're more comfortable that way when we are a small presence in sort of a vast environment. When we're looking at the ocean, when we're in the mountains, those are not places in which we feel like we're the center of the universe. We feel like we're sort of a small, very insignificant part of it. And I think for a lot of people, sort of in a contradictory and yet at the same time very intuitive way, that's very comforting, because it means the world is not going to fall apart based on your one bad decision. The mountains will still be there. The ocean will still be there. I think that's true of artificial environments as well. You know, we love space opera when we're in these, you know, huge artificial, you know, moon colonies or what have you. And so I think especially in the kind of writing I do, genre fiction, the environment is always an extra character on the page for that very reason, because it is a way in which we contextualize everything else.
We have a question from a student that kind of connects to that. Could you give us some examples of effective narratives that have been able to get at reestablishing humans' lost connections with nature?
Well, I mean, you mentioned Wild, which is a perfect example, but there are so many, actually, when you begin to look. There are, I mean, the ones that are actual, real-life tellings. I love to read stories about mountain climbing and mountain expeditions. So I think if you look around, you can find an awful lot. For me, you know, I was thinking, such a little child's book, but it was so meaningful to me, The Secret Garden. I don't know if you ever read that. And I was thinking about it the other day. In fact, I was talking about it in the Nature panel. It, you know, sometimes the childhood books that we read really brought us into an enchanted and wonderful relationship with nature. And this one, when I went back and read it about a year ago, The Secret Garden, I realized in a way it held the seeds for my entire life and my interests. And so a great place to look is there. I mean, we have the Romantics, we have, oh gosh, so many. I'll leave it to other people to add to the list.
So I think adventure stories are a key, that we all want adventure, but we can't always have it. So we get a dose of it through reading and reconnecting with these mountain climbers, or you know, I have to get my dose of Outside Magazine, you know, to keep connecting with people doing wonderful things in the outside that I don't get to do anymore. Or you know, we all stop our brains. We all think we're 25 or 27. We get older and older, but somehow in our head, we're still 25. And it's a very common experience, and I think that we find that part of ourselves in these stories where the 25-year-olds are out doing these things. So that's...
So we... I don't know if anyone else wants to... Do you want to comment? We do have a question for Willow from a student. What books would you recommend for an aspiring 17-year-old comic book writer, and what other advice? So.
Oh, gosh, what a good question. Of course, there's the famous Scott McCloud treatise on comics, which I think is as relevant today as when it was written, gosh, now 25 or 30 years ago. But I think I have to say I have not been super impressed by any of the sort of technical academic treatises on comics that I have seen. This is no offense to, I mean, this is kind of a burgeoning thing now to finally treat comics like a legit literary category. But I think people are still kind of finding their footing about how to talk about them. So if I were you, I would do the following. Read a lot of comics, and then sit with them and write all over them to figure out how they work. In other words, number the panels on the page so you can say, okay, I love Alan Moore. And he uses these really crowded, like 9 or 10 panel pages with a lot of dialogue, and everything is very decompressed. But I also like Brian Michael Bendis, who will have these giant, you know, full page splashes with very little dialogue and communicates a lot through action. See roughly how much dialogue you like when you're a reader looking at that page and say, okay, so I don't like these really crowded panels. I like the art to breathe. I don't like a whole ton of dialogue. Or maybe you do. Maybe you like paragraphs of text juxtaposed with a single image. So it really is, I think, still at this point, a very DIY. Is that it? DIY. There we go. I am not sufficiently caffeinated yet this morning. I haven't had breakfast.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start speaking in tongues here in a second. But yeah, it's still very much a do-it-yourself kind of a medium. There is not a whole lot out there about how to write comics. So I would just read the comics that you like, figure out what you like about them, which is a big thing, and then practice. Write scripts, or if you're an artist, you know, map out pages and go online and read some of the scripts that your favorite writers have posted, because I guarantee they're out there. And try to sort of teach yourself. That's what everybody in the industry has learned that way at this point. And until there's a more rigorous sort of academic track for learning how to do this stuff, it will be something you have to learn on your own.
Are there particular series that you recommend?
Oh, well, it depends on for what. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you've got the very literary comics, like Neil Gaiman's Sandman, and Alan Moore's, really anything Alan Moore has written, like From Hell or Watchmen, which is considered sort of one of the seminal meta-commentaries on the superhero genre. You know, or there's stuff that gets very much into the guts of what it is to be a superhero. Brian Michael Bendis's run on Daredevil from the late 90s and early 2000s is a great example of that. Grant Morrison's All-Star Superman is another fantastic one. There's also, I'll plug this one. My favorite comic book series of all time is called Shade the Changing Man, specifically the revamp in the late 80s and early 90s written by Peter Milligan. It's sort of a reimagining of a very trippy 1960s Steve Ditko character as this dimension-hopping guy who can warp reality around him, and it gets into what is America, what are our American mythologies. It talks about gender fluidity and relationships way before those became issues that we were discussing as a culture. So if you can find that, it's a bit difficult to find, but if you can find it, it's excellent. Shade the changing man. Shade like throwing shade.
If this is you before caffeine, I'm very intimidated to talk to you after caffeine.
So far we just have a comment that's coming through the app. So if you have submitted something and it's not there, let me know. And the commenter says, as an engineer and project manager, I use narratives to define process goals and successes, and it worked. So we have another student question. Are there alternative narrative structures that work? How much can you change in that beginning, middle, end, and protagonist structure?
I think there definitely are many alternative narratives. And I think it has to do with that thing I was speaking about, the order of events, right? So that the order of events does not necessitate a linear or a chronological order. But I think that still the choices of how you order events are kind of the key to structure. I think what tends to happen is that as audiences, we take in nonlinear structure and we admire it, and then we want to do it because it seems more interesting to us than something traditional. So for me as a teacher of screenwriting, it's every kid that ever came in my class and wanted to write Spotless Mind, right? What's the full?
The Eternal
Sunshine. Yes. Sorry, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, right? So an entire generation of storytellers saw that movie and wanted to write the next one of those. I think what a lot of them maybe didn't understand is that there's a tremendous amount of craft to writing something that feels random, that feels purely intuitive. Some people I think actually have an intuitive lens where the first draft of something can be nonlinear and they are just guided by their intuition about what the order should be. It's a hard thing to teach if you don't have that coming intuitively. So when I try to help someone with that, I usually tell them, okay, follow your intuition. If you get stuck, if it starts to feel random or overwhelming, then go ahead and put everything in order first, so that tells you what the linear version of this story would be, and then start playing with that order, start mixing it up, and see how that sense of what you're doing changes until you feel the one, you know, that works. Similarly, if you're working backwards, you know, if you're having a narrative that starts at the end and moves to the beginning. I think, you know, even when you're talking about multiple protagonists, again, it's a similar process for me in that I've written a few ensemble pieces that don't focus on one protagonist, but I still actually then consider each member of the ensemble their own protagonist of their own story and kind of figure out what are the major events that create an arc for them, and then how do I weave that in with someone else. So I personally sort of really always come back to the backbone of narrative, even when I'm playing with it. But I have met artists who don't need to do that, but I feel that that's a special gift and one that's very hard for me as a teacher to kind of teach someone to do.
Like to add here, I write a lot of essays, and essays are interesting things. I mean, the word really comes from the idea of to attempt something, to try something, and essays are, I mean, I struggled, so even though I was called to that particular form, I really, really struggled with it, because it really is a weaving that happens, and like you were saying, the backbone, I mean, those... In an essay, you really have to keep the thread going, but it might start in one place. You may have a wonderful kind of, you know, going off and exploring some other avenue over here, but then you have to weave it back into the main thread again. There may be a little personal narrative that happens, and you might put in a bit of fact. And so it really is this kind of tapestry that occurs. And it can get to a very chaotic place where, you know, you just go, like total panic. Like, how do I find the end? Where is it going to come home to? So often it's a sort of act of faith and intuition and trusting that, you know, that you are, if you follow that thread, that it will lead you home again.
Great. So we may have already covered this, but there's a question. Do you have any other suggestions for storytelling practice? I kind of think about oral storytelling or, other things. But do you guys have any other suggestions we haven't covered?
Well, I do. I love what you say about a daily practice. I mean, it's like, if we were to think that we could go to the gym once a week, we know we wouldn't make progress, right? I like to keep a journal. I do a lot of work with people who are journaling people. And one of the things that I always suggest that people do is after they've written whatever it is they want, and journal is a wonderful way just to be completely free, and just like you were saying, Amy, you don't have to worry about, what you're saying, how you're saying it, just let it out. But then after you've done that, to make a practice of reading it through and just saying, what do I notice, what surprises me here, so that you have a self-reflection piece. And then always title it. Doesn't have to be a great title, but title what you've written and date it. And it's amazing then if you can go back and look at those journals, it really becomes a rich resource for ideas that can spark your creativity.
Another, there's a book called The Artist's Way that a lot of people love and a lot of people hate, and I have a very mixed, I don't love it, but I love parts of it. It's often considered like a 12-step program for artists, but it's by a woman named Julia Cameron. But it has one thing in it that I really like and that I've started to use in my classes, which is this, what she calls the artist's date. And she talks about the artist's date as something playful and whimsical and outside of the routine of your life that you let yourself do once a week. And I've started to use it because I teach in the grad film program at NYU, and my students, it's a very intensive program. And one thing I discovered is that when my students start the program, they come in and in their interviews when we're selecting them, they'll talk about their influences, they'll talk about walking through the woods, they'll talk about a painting, they'll talk about anything. You can see that they have like these rich, fertile minds, and that they're really drawing upon the world and their memories and their experiences and their inspirations to try to create work. But then they come to our program, and after 2 years of living in New York City, meeting really intense deadlines, not getting outside of the Tisch building very much because they're editing films, only interacting with each other, you actually see the scope of their work start to kind of narrow. And they start talking about film the way that filmmakers talk about film instead of the way that regular people talk about film. And so there's a class that I get them in at that moment. And what I do, the only homework I give them for the first 4 weeks is to go on an artist date that week and to come back and write a half a page about what it felt like. And I have been so inspired just reading their accounts because they do all sorts of things. Some of them go to a museum. Some of them walk their dogs. But just, a lot of times, it's interesting. One thing people will say a lot is like, well, I walk a lot, but I usually have my headphones on, and I turned them off and just looked around. So the things that people come up with that kind of take them out of their routine and then the impact that has on them is quite powerful.
I think also all good writers or storytellers start out as good readers. And I'd say, personally, the thing that's had the most long-running and visible, to me at least, impact on my own craft is reading. I'm always in the middle of a book. Don't be afraid to not finish a book you think is terrible. Most books are terrible. I mean, this is just honest talk here. But if you can get to what, if you can accurately describe what it is you enjoyed about a book, you have gone a long way to being able to replicate it. And you cannot underestimate that skill.
Great. We have a couple questions on climate change and environmental protection. So the first one is, what narratives will work to get people to take it serious, to understand how imminent it is and how long-lasting the impact will be?
So that was the question I was going to ask if I got the opportunity. So with the wealth of knowledge up here, I feel like the thing that bothers me most as a climate scientist and leading NASA's climate research endeavor is running into the people who say, I don't believe in climate change.
Oh, God.
You know, and it's like, I'm sorry, it's it's a non sequitur. I don't get that it's a belief system, that it's some sort of religion. And I feel like just giving more facts is like when there's somebody, you have a language problem with somebody, you just can't speak louder and more slowly. That doesn't work. So we need to, I'm feeling like there's this idea of using the narrative and the protagonist and in a way to connect with this believer or non-believer in an emotional way, that it isn't about transmitting facts, but we have to reach into their guts and their heart and to get the caring about the trajectory of the world. Mm-hmm. And so I just haven't seen a lot of that done. How do we get that done?
And let me read this other question that's kind of connected before the rest of you comment, and Eric, if you have anything to add. I was wondering why environmental protection, a life-death issue for humanity, is not as evident in the street protests as immigration or refugee issues. Someone told me the environment has no human face, though it does. How do you bring this problem to the fore?
I hope you're going to the March for Science, happening this month. So yeah, there is a march. I was just thinking as you were talking that maybe when we speak specifically about getting people who don't believe in climate change or what have you, or who maybe in their heart of hearts believe in climate change but prioritize other things like, for example, I don't know, big business or ranching or what have you, that maybe we have the wrong protagonists in the narrative. Because, you know, when I see a movie or even like a commercial about dying panda bears or whales, like I'm a mark for that. I am sobbing. But maybe those people don't need to hear that story. Maybe they need to hear about the rancher as the potential victim of climate change. Or, you know, like the businessman as the potential victim of climate change. Like this is something that affects the things that they care about, which might not make a whole ton of sense to those of us who cry at, you know, stories about dying panda bears, but to them, that's the protagonist that gets into their sort of gut function as opposed to that wall that they put up.
I think something else which is really, really true is that it's so terrifying. There's just a deep, deep level of fear, and with fear will come a deep, deep level of denial. And so I think that, that really has to be factored in. And, you know, somebody on the panel was talking about narrative being in the moment of the now. And, you know, the reality is that all the climate change is happening now, but we still talk about it as though it was going to happen in the future. And so I think there's this real shift that we have to do about presencing what's happening with the environment and not talking about it as a future thing. It is here and now, and actually we're all experiencing it. And anybody, you know, I talk to friends who work on the land, anybody who works on the land, whatever their belief system, and they give different reasons for it. Well, you know, there are always cycles of climate change and blah, 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 blah. You know, droughts happen, blah, blah. They know. You know, if you live close to the land, you know big stuff is stirring and happening and changing. And it's the interpretation of that gets really wobbly.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that just strikes me as a possibility, I like to be a little sneaky. And I think that obviously, like, these people that don't believe in climate change, that's coming from somewhere, right? That's an agenda that a different narrative has been fed to those people. And I think that because we're in these entrenched sides right now and everything is very politicized, I think it's very difficult to take on. I mean, the corporate interests, the interests that have fed into the denial of climate change are powerful and rich. And I think it's hard to take them on maybe with a nice story about dolphins or, you know. And I almost wonder if some of the things that you've been speaking about just rekindling people's connection to the natural world is the first step, so that you're not wading right into the most politicized water. You're not saying to someone to appreciate this story, you have to agree that climate change is happening. You're just saying, let's just reconnect you to nature and maybe, I don't know, send you back to a place you were as a child so you can actually see how it's changed. Or I just wonder if there's a sneaky way to wake up that part of people without overtly politicizing it, where they might push it away.
There's a student question that kind of connects to that, saying that people watch nature series like Planet Earth or Red Adventure, but how do you harness that, and they're more in awe of it, how do you harness that awe to re-engage them in the environmental movement?
We love to watch those programs. I mean, they're so awe-inspiring, but in a way they're also a little misleading, because they give the impression, even though the voiceover tells you that these creatures are endangered and so on and so forth, you get the sense that the Earth is still teeming and teeming with life. And you forget the fact that the photographer spent, 6 years getting that photograph of the snow leopard, right? So, but I do think awe is a portal, and I loved what Amy said about connecting people to their stories, and asking them. That's one of the things that I do a lot in my groups, is have people talk about their own personal losses, a tree that was cut down, a meadow that was paved over. And there's even this new word that's emerged called solastalgia, which is sort of to live in the moment with the fear of losing. This is a kind of pervasive anxiety many of us feel, that even while we may be living in a beautiful place like Boulder, there's still that fear that we are going to lose that beauty. And coming at it from, religion got off book, right? Heaven was out here. When we talk about awe, I think we need to remember that this place that we live and inhabit is an absolute, blessed, beautiful miracle. And that's part of the story. Yeah.
Okay. So right now we have three more questions. This one is, how do you think culture affects how a person consumes and produces content? Do you think Western culture has a gap of narrative?
I think the very fact that we've started to refer to stories as content, i.e. something to be bought and sold, tells us a lot about the impact of culture on storytelling. I've been hearing this a lot, too. I do a lot of sort of workshop-y or, small group type events with prospective storytellers, people who want to go on and do, writing or design or film or something like that. And they've all started to refer to stories as content. And, very naturally and very, intuitively, and it just comes unprompted. And that scares me a little bit. because it means that the reason for being of those stories has changed. They're not now something that has a message or is meant to entertain or has some sort of higher function. They're simply products to be sold or consumed, and that changes not only how you consume the stories but how you tell them. And I don't like to be one of these, like, oh, the future is always bad and change is always bad types of people, because I think, we'll survive either way. But I would encourage people, especially younger people who are now coming into this sort of post-capitalist way of consuming media, to stop thinking about stories as content and start thinking of them again as narratives.
I was just going to make a little comment on that. It seems like we're on the trajectory for a more content-free culture obsessed about content.
Yeah. Content without information.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
Well, and it's interesting because we're so overwhelmed by stories right now. I mean, we're overwhelmed by information. We're also overwhelmed by stories. I mean, I think Ted Hope, who currently, I think, is at Amazon. He's a big leader in film, but he changes jobs every year, so I never know where he is. But he speaks about, he's crunched the numbers, and I don't remember them exactly, but it's something like he's a huge film lover and a filmmaker, and he said, if I were to watch 3 movies a day for the rest of my life, I would not watch, you know, I don't know, 1/10 of the movies that are out there. There's too much. There are too many stories on our televisions, and then other medium like books, or people are reading less and taking in more. And I think that I would rather people, just going along with what you said, I would rather people actually consume or invest in fewer stories and actually take the time to be thoughtful about those stories, take the time to read about those, to have a context for those stories. Because I think there's this thing, like we all have like a Netflix queue and we're just checking them off, like to catch up, you know, and to be able to seem like we've seen the latest thing that everyone else has seen. And I think that it is troubling. And, you know, just as a personal experience with Equity, which I mentioned, this ending, which is not, I mean, as an independent filmmaker, I've seen some pretty dark, disturbing endings in my time. My film is really not that dark and disturbing. It just has a character that fundamentally doesn't get the thing she's been fighting for the whole movie. But the response to that ending by so many audiences has been fascinating. People, many people love it. It makes them think. But I, you know, this is an independent film, and so the audience is already, you know, it's not a blockbuster, it's not a mass audience. You've already got a pretty educated public that has seen this movie. They've sought it out at an independent cinema or at a film festival. And in every audience, there's a lot of people that are, they'd say, how could you do that to me? Basically, you know, how could you make me uncomfortable? That's not why I go to the movies. I go to the movies for a happy ending, to get entertained. And that, to me, is a consumer mindset, right? Like, you want that, go get some ice cream, right? Like, that's not the reason to see a story necessarily. I like to be entertained, too, but it's not the only thing I want. And I've even had, and it's funny because when I'll mention this to people, they'll say, oh, don't get worried, like, don't feel bad. And I don't feel bad. I find it fascinating, but I'll get these emails. And individual people will write to me to tell me why I got the ending wrong of my story. Oh. And they'll say, I loved your movie, I loved it, but I really don't like the ending, and here's why. And it's so interesting to me that someone can turn on their TV and think that presume that they should tell the storyteller, you messed up the ending. And I just, that's fascinating to me. And as opposed to, I actually wrote a couple articles about the ending. And then it's interesting because people who have taken the time after not liking the ending to actually Google and find the article and read it then will come to me and we'll have a much more interesting, nuanced discussion. But most people just want to turn it on, give it an hour and a half, and own their reaction. You know.
So maybe one of you can answer this. We have one question and one something for each of you that's very quick. So does our desire for narrative have anything to do with our awareness of linear time and that at some point in time we will no longer be here?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So okay. So we have about 1 minute or 2 minutes. This question is for all of you. What is your favorite narrative?
You know, oh, God, I am such a traditionalist. I'm almost shame. You know, I love Jane Austen. I just absolutely, and it's because I get so invested, despite all, sometimes my better nature, in the outcome.
So there's a book that I feel is this narrative. It's called A Walk Through Time by Colin Fletcher. It's probably from the 40s or 50s, about walking through from one end of the Grand Canyon to the other. And it's that narrative of experiencing nature in a very fundamental way.
This is terrible, and I don't have an answer right now. I'm having to think about it.
More coffee.
I kind of like stories about heroic failures, stories with an ending that isn't necessarily happy. In which, or alternately, in which achieving the end goal requires a sacrifice that makes sort of the good and evil or the input output more or less equal, like the Lord of the Rings. Like, yes, we destroyed the ring, but now, you know, it's basically killed the people who got it there. Or, oh my God, Arrival.
which I just recently saw, which is a fantastic way of not only looking at what we consider, you know, what we are willing to sacrifice, but also how we describe time in stories. And, oh my God, I was just totally blown away. So those are the stories that tend to appeal to me. Like, yes, you can get the thing you desire, but it may cost you more than you thought.